Today is Wednesday, October 21st, and you're listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Thailand's prime minister says he'll lift a state of emergency, but protesters demand his resignation.
Young people here just sort of say, when we talk to them on the streets, we've had enough.
Also ahead, COVID-19 cases surge in Europe.
Spain and France and Belgium and the Netherlands, they are having much stricter lockdowns, some of them localized, some of them national.
Plus, Netflix says it wants more movies made in Africa. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Thailand, where tens of thousands of protesters marched toward the prime minister's office today, demanding his resignation despite government attempts to quell the demonstrations. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, who took power in a 2014 coup, said today he was preparing to lift a state of emergency imposed last week if there was no violence. Prayut, who denies accusations that he rigged an election last year, pleaded with protesters to resolve political differences through parliament. The protests began in July but have swelled over the past 8 days. Demonstrators also are demanding constitutional changes, more freedoms for students, and reforms to the country's powerful monarchy. The state of emergency was part of a string of unsuccessful measures attempted by Prayut's government in recent days to try to tamp down the protests. The government also clamped down on media, used a water cannon against demonstrators, and arrested a number of marchers. Some of those arrested have since been granted bail. The lifting of the state of emergency did not appear to satisfy demonstrators, however. One prominent Thai protester, Thai Tep Rong Praphai Kitsari, said Prayut must first resign, then other demands could be discussed in parliament. Philip Sherwell is the Asia correspondent for the Sunday Times and has been covering the demonstrations in Bangkok. I reached out to him for more on the situation. Philip, why have these protests kept going despite the government's attempts to shut them down?
Yeah, they feel that they started off with relatively moderate political requests earlier this year when these protests first started. They were triggered by the banning of a popular progressive opposition party that did very well with young voters last year in the elections. They were demanding political reforms. Then those reforms, those demands have morphed into calls for the prime minister to step down. And a couple of months ago, they did then take this very dramatic turn of calls for royal reforms. These are primarily students. They're primarily young people. They really do feel that this society needs to change. It's a very hierarchical, top-down society. And exactly what they are protesting against, which is orders being sort of set down from the military and requirements to behave certain ways in school and the whole sort of royal tradition and etiquette, that's what they're sort of fighting against. So when this same government was saying no concessions, you know, they were hinting that in a couple of years maybe they could consider changing the constitution, but really no concessions, no compromise, and now you have to stop and go home, that just further incited people and further angered people. And there is just this mood now of, if not now, then when? There is a hashtag of, you know, end this in our generation. And young people here just sort of say, when we talk to them on the streets, we've had enough.
And can you describe what's it been like at the protests? You know, what does it feel like? What does it look like?
Yes, it's actually interesting. I reported a lot from Hong Kong last year, and there is a distinct feeling of those sort of Hong Kong leaderless protests, you know, where sort of people are on social media apps. They're sort of talking to each other as they gather. There's the flashing of the lights from the phones at night. The defiance and anger is also mixed with quite a bit of good humor. There's a lot of coded language playing on Thai puns and language to sort of refer to the police and the government. They're very intent on holding their ground. And when I say holding their ground, I mean their ground is very much, they move the demonstrations each day. They only announce them very late on. They don't want to sort of make the mistake of trying to carve out a particular protest site and then it'll be easy, as they see it, for the police and the security forces to move in the trucks and the riot squads. There are also protests now taking place across the country in smaller numbers, but outside Bangkok. So it does feel at the moment as though the country's really facing a very considerable very deep standoff and very deep rift, because these people aren't going home, but there are very substantial bodies of support for the establishment. There's still deep respect and veneration for the royal family amongst large swathes of the population. So it's quite a split society at the moment.
That was Philip Sherwell, Asia correspondent for the Sunday Times, who is covering the protests in Bangkok. The Greek Navy has issued a Code Orange alert, advising battleships to protect a cluster of tiny islands in the southeast Aegean Sea and be prepared for any hostile action from Turkey. For VOA, Anthi Karasava has the story.
Greece's defense ministry on Wednesday released pictures of what Greek officials called a protective wall, illustrating what it called the severity of the looming standoff with Turkey. Military officials tell VOA Greek gunboats circled Kastellorizo and a number of uninhabited islands in a move they said is meant to shield Greek territory against Turkish attempts to survey disputed waters for oil and gas. Ankara redeployed the Oroochre survey ship earlier this month, just weeks after it had recalled it from a similar mission that nearly brought Greece and Turkey to the brink of war over energy rights in the eastern Mediterranean. U.S. and EU officials have since then been trying to get both sides to sit down and negotiate their differences. But analysts say what makes this redeployment dangerous is that the Turkish vessel has come so close to the Greek coast. The Code Orange alert was issued as the Oroochre sailed just 14 kilometers off the shores of Kastellorizo, the nearest any Turkish vessel has come to a Greek island during the standoff. The survey ship has since then been entering the contested zone, guarded by a formation of Turkish battleships and submarines. More than 60 Greek ships are in the region monitoring the vessel's moves. Ankara insists it is within its rights to survey the region for gas and oil. But Greek government officials like State Minister Yorgos Hierapetritis warn that any breach of Greek sovereignty will be met with force. He says Greece will never allow any illegal drilling to take place, and it will never relinquish its sovereign rights to exploit the seabed as far as 19 kilometers from the coast of Greek islands. NATO allies Greece and Turkey have long been at odds over conflicting oil and sea rights. Athens is now trying to convince the EU member states to stop selling arms to Turkey. It also wants to impose sanctions on Turkey, a bid that Germany and others are strongly resisting. Alexis Papagelas, managing editor and a commentator on defense and foreign policy at the Kathimerini newspaper in Athens, warns that the Greek Navy buildup marks an escalation of tensions that could be playing into Turkey's hands.
He
says this is an ongoing war of nerves, and that the biggest fear is for the Greek side to fall in the trap of escalating tension, he says. That's exactly what Ankara wants right now in order to pin the blame on Greece. The Oroochre is expected to complete its survey later this week, but observers say it may get orders to stay longer to explore for oil and gas, something that could prolong the tensions. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
A U.S. lawsuit has accused the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of ordering the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The case was filed on Tuesday by Khashoggi's fiancé and the human rights group he founded before his death in 2018. Flora Bradley Watson with Reuters reports.
The fiancé of slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi is suing Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince. She and a human rights group Khashoggi founded filed a lawsuit in a U.S. court on Tuesday, accusing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of ordering the journalist's murder. The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages against the Crown Prince and 20 other Saudis and risks raising tensions between Washington and Riyadh. Saudi Arabia is already in the spotlight for its poor human rights record, as well as its role in the seemingly intractable war in Yemen. Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad back in 2018 after he entered the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. He was there to obtain papers he needed to marry Hatice Cengiz, a Turkish citizen. Khashoggi was a well-known US-based journalist who had written critical pieces about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The lawsuit accuses MBS and the other Saudis of carrying out a plot to, quote, permanently silence Mr. Khashoggi. It says the kingdom was worried about Khashoggi using his organization, Democracy for the Arab World Now, as a platform to bring about political change. The suit falls under a law allowing US court actions against foreign officials over allegations of involvement in torture or extrajudicial killings. The Saudi embassy did not immediately respond to requests for comment on the lawsuit, but the Crown Prince has previously denied ordering Khashoggi's murder.
Thanks to Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters for that report. This is VOA. Officials in Afghanistan say a stampede near Pakistan's consulate in Jalalabad and insurgent attacks elsewhere in the country have killed about 50 people. Witnesses said thousands of Afghans had gathered Wednesday morning in a stadium outside the consulate to collect tokens required to apply for a Pakistani visa before jostling broke out among applicants. A provincial government spokesman told VOA at least 15 people, including 11 elderly women, were crushed to death in the ensuing stampede. Authorities in Afghanistan's northeastern Takhar province said Wednesday the Taliban there had killed at least 34 government forces in overnight attacks. A local government spokesman told VOA the provincial police chief for security was among the dead. A member of the grand jury in the case of the shooting death by police of black woman Breonna Taylor earlier this year is taking issue with statements by Kentucky's attorney general, the AP reports. Taylor was killed during a raid by white police officers in March in the U.S. state of Kentucky, an incident that fueled protests throughout the summer. Both the police and Taylor's boyfriend, who shot at the intruders without knowing they were police, said they fired in self-defense. Kentucky Attorney General David Cameron, who is black, filed no charges in connection for Taylor's death. He said last month that prosecutors, quote, walked the grand jury through every homicide offense, end quote, and that jurors agreed the officers were justified in their actions. But the anonymous grand juror said late Tuesday the jury was not given the option to consider charges for Taylor's death. The juror said they, quote, didn't agree that certain actions were justified, end quote, and that the jury, quote, did not have homicide charges explained to them, end quote. Cameron has acknowledged his prosecutors did not offer homicide charges against two officers in the case. He said Tuesday it was his decision, quote, to ask for an indictment that could be proven under Kentucky law, end quote. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Total global COVID-19 cases are at over 40 million with more than 1.1 million deaths. The largest outbreaks are in the Americas, India, and in Europe, where the World Health Organization says it has again recorded a new high in the weekly number of coronavirus cases. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has the story.
The figure, 927,000, supports the WHO view that the region has continued to show a rapid increase in cases and deaths, noting the continent saw a 25% spike in cases last week and was responsible for 38% of all new cases reported worldwide. The UN Health Agency also says France, Britain, Russia, the Czech Republic and Italy are responsible for more than half of the new COVID-19 cases in the region. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
One of the European countries struggling with new outbreaks is the United Kingdom. Hard lockdowns earlier this year saw cases drop from a high of over 5,400 cases in a single day in late April to just four new cases one day in July. But in the last month, daily cases have shot up with an average of over 18,000 cases a day over the last week. For more, I reached out to journalist Henry Ridgewell in London.
So the government is trying to impose these localized lockdowns on the hotspot areas around the country, a change of policy from what we saw in the spring with the nationwide lockdown. So the city of Liverpool in the north of England is currently under what's known as tier three lockdowns, where most non-essential businesses are closed, schools remain open, but people are encouraged to work from home. There are other hotspots in Britain, namely the cities of Manchester and Nottingham and Lincoln and some other cities, where the coronavirus cases are very high. The government has for several days been trying to persuade local authorities to accept these tier three restrictions, but local authorities have been resisting it, saying A, that there is no evidence that these sort of limited lockdowns work, and secondly, that the government isn't giving them enough support, financial support, to get through these lockdowns.
Well, what does the science say?
The science is divided on this. Because of the nature of the virus, it's only been with us for a matter of months. Of course, scientists don't know everything about it, but there is evidence to suggest that schools and universities, some of these places that are remaining open, where people are still mixing, are sort of hotspots for the disease, but also that there are no travel restrictions in the country. So trying to impose closures of businesses on certain areas to try to restrict the virus, when schools and universities and some other businesses are remaining open, when people are free to move, when public transport remains operational and there are still crowds gathering in certain areas, some local political leaders say this just doesn't make sense.
How does it compare to other countries in the region?
If you compare Britain to other countries, notably Ireland, which is about to enter a much stricter six-week effective lockdown, although with schools still open, Spain and France and Belgium and the Netherlands, they are having much stricter lockdowns, some of them localized, some of them national. Britain is later, and indeed the scientific group that's advising the government did push for a so-called circuit breaker lockdown of 2 or 3 weeks back in September. The government has resisted this because it says the scientific input on the spread of the virus is just one of the factors that they have to consider. They say these local measures have to be given time to see if they work, and the option of a national lockdown is still there if it's needed. Critics say, well, that kind of delay could lead to thousands more deaths, potentially as many as 15 or 20,000 more deaths by the end of the year.
That was journalist Henry Ridgewell in London. Doctors are scrambling to understand the effects of COVID-19 on pregnancies. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
When a woman is pregnant, her immune system changes to protect her growing baby. But these changes make her more vulnerable to certain viruses, such as the flu, and increase her risk of serious health problems. So far, studies about pregnant women infected with the new coronavirus show both reassuring and alarming results. The Cleveland Clinic's Dr. Tosin Gogi says recent evidence suggests pregnant women may face more severe health problems if they have COVID-19.
They had increased hospitalization, and they had increased ICU admission, and they had increased receipt of a mechanical ventilation when they compared them to women of the same reproductive age with COVID-19 that were not pregnant.
Doctors are trying to determine if COVID-19 is more dangerous for pregnant women than getting the flu. Dr. Brenna Hughes is a maternal and fetal medicine physician at Duke University.
It appears at this point that it is actually not as severe as influenza is during pregnancy.
Yet the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says pregnant women who get COVID-19 and are hospitalized have higher rates of serious illnesses, are more likely to have miscarriages, deliver babies prematurely, and more likely to have stillborn babies. Other studies contradict these results.
I think that we need to take a step back a little bit in that since COVID-19 is so new, we don't have all of the data that we really need to make an assessment as to what level of risk it imparts on a pregnant woman.
For example, could stress be a factor? Pandemic-related hurdles to prenatal care, like lockdowns, prevented some women from getting checkups or even getting medical care when giving birth. Some women put off seeing their doctors out of fear of getting the coronavirus. Dr. Hughes says women need to see their doctors in their last trimester.
Prenatal care, particularly in the third trimester, is one of the ways that we ensure both mother's health and ensure that there aren't stillbirths.
Until more is known, pregnant women need to protect themselves from the coronavirus by wearing face masks, social distancing, avoiding crowds, and practicing good hand hygiene. Doctors say women also need to call their physician if they notice decreased fetal movement. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
A senior Netflix Inc. executive says the video streaming service is trying to focus more on movies made in Africa. Saraya Ali of Reuters has that story.
How does a big online streaming service like Netflix make inroads into a place like the African continent, where internet can be slow, expensive, and not everyone has a credit card? The answer, working through the telecoms operators themselves, making a Netflix subscription a part of customers' regular internet bill. That and other strategies are all about ease of access, according to its head of programming for Africa, Dorothy Getuba.
The business is excited about Africa, and it's putting every effort behind it. And we are investing very seriously in it. And in terms of our strategy, we've always said that we do believe that great stories come from anywhere and they can be loved everywhere across the world. And it's no different with African stories.
The online giant, which has 193 million subscribers globally, is seeking ways to overcome the challenges of expanding to the 55-nation continent. Netflix already has partnerships with operators like Vodacom and Telkom South Africa.
Plans for the continent.
As to internet speeds, Getuba says they're trying to address it by allowing Wi-Fi downloads for later viewing, rather than pricey mobile data for streaming. But Netflix isn't the only player. The pay TV market in Africa is dominated by South Africa's Multi-Choice Group. It has dozens of channels dedicated to news and live sports events and an online streaming service, giving it an edge over Netflix.
It has to be 15 babes.
To improve its market appeal, Netflix has been boosting its library of African productions, like its first Kenyan film, Poacher.
We want to be able to say that Africa has got as many stories as the people in it. And so it's important for us to provide for our members across the globe that range and diversity of content from Africa. But we are truly, truly invested in Africa.
Getuba declined to specify the value of Netflix's investments in Africa, but the company has agreed to a slew of content licensing deals with African producers in Senegal, Ghana, Zimbabwe, Angola, and Mozambique.
Thanks to Saraya Ali of Reuters for that report. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, around 300,000 children in sub-Saharan Africa are born with sickle cell disease, caused by an ancient mutation in one of the genes governing the development of hemoglobin. The disease causes extreme pain, organ and immune system damage. That damage to the immune system happens very, very early, so children who don't get appropriate care can die of bacterial infections very rapidly, explains Brett Gerois, a pediatric doctor and admiral in the United States Public Health Service, who currently serves as the Assistant Secretary for Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Indeed, in low and middle income countries, an estimated 80% of children with sickle cell disease die before the age of five. Because sickle cell disease is the most common genetic disorder among African Americans, the United States has really taken bold leadership in bringing sickle cell disease to the forefront, said Admiral Gerois. Internationally, the United States is working with countries like Uganda, which just published a national plan to deal with sickle cell disease. The Ugandan plan, I think, is really a landmark, said Admiral Gerois.
It's a specific plan. It's fully costed. It's done chronologically, so we know what needs to be done when. So it's a really robust plan that can serve as an example for the rest of the continent.
It's important to note that this plan was made by the nation of Uganda for the people of Uganda, said Admiral Gerois.
What Uganda did is it did a survey to understand, even within a country, there are many regions where sickle cell is much more common than other places. And these are sort of the accidents of genetics with who lives in those areas and how it developed over a period of time. So this is a targeted plan. So it starts where the places that have the worst effects of sickle cell are. So there are about 75 health districts that they're going to focus on first and then expand it.
Uganda has agreed to allow its plan to be disseminated throughout Africa. It will need to be adapted to the people, to the culture and economic situation of each country. But that can easily happen, said Adil Jirwa. The first step is to have a plan. The second step is to really execute that plan. But we are in a really great position to make the plan and to execute it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.